Hello, hello. Welcome to One Wild World, a podcast by The Echo. I'm your host, Matthew Juno.
And I'm the editor, Mike Davis.
I want to open up today by talking about migration, which is the seasonal journey of a species of animals from one region to another, then often back to where they came from. There are lots of different types of animals that migrate, and even different types of migrations. Do you know which animal travels the farthest in its migration?
Penguins?
Oh, gosh.
Morgan Freeman really made it seem like it was a long way, despite the fact that they're so mobility limited. But
it was a march of the penguins, I will give you that.
A very long march. But no, seriously, probably seagulls. You really see them in odd places sometimes, such as inland parking lots.
Yeah, they do seem to just end up in the strangest places. Those are some good guesses, but no. The most migratory animal is the Arctic tern, which is a bird believed to migrate around 25,000 miles in a year. From around the North Pole all the way down to the South Pole, they're traveling Arctic to Antarctic and back again, which is pretty cool. Am I right?
So what put the topic of migration on your mind?
Well, just as the animals that migrate take these long journeys to distant places and then return to where they began, today's guest works with an organization who we were able to feature in our very first video back in 2015.
We did get a lot of really cool footage, I think.
I totally agree. Some of those clips we captured are still etched into my memory, along with many of the things we learned when we visited. Before we complete our own migratory cycle, we have one more stop, and that is to play a round of
What's That?
Today, I have another special round of What's That Animal? We so often hear the calls of animals, but today I want to explore why that animal is making the sound. So when you hear this audio, try to guess the animal, as well as why the animal might be making that sound. The animal may not be too surprising, especially knowing where today's guest works, but one more time, let's hear the sound. Stick around to the end of the episode to find out if you're a true animal detective. Now, to get more insight for the animal featured, we have a great conversation with Keith LaPosh, rescue coordinator and volunteer for Wolf Sanctuary. Let's head over to my conversation with him now. The Echo's first video was actually with the Wolf Sanctuary. We got to go out and see the property and actually get to meet some of the wolves and wolf dogs that are there. So I'm hoping to have you kind of break apart, what is the Wolf Sanctuary and what work do you do there?
First off, our name is Wolf Sanctuary, and WOLF is an acronym. It stands for Wolves Offered Life and Friendship. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and our mission is to improve the quality of life for all wolves and wolf dogs through rescue, sanctuary, and education. All of the animals that we rescue stay with us for their entire life. We do not release into the wild. We do not adopt out. All of the animals are spayed or neutered unless there is some medical reason they cannot be. And we are a no-kill facility. So the only time euthanasia is considered is when the quality of life has diminished to the point where the animal is beginning to suffer. Then we help them to peacefully cross over. Our habitats are anywhere from a quarter acre to an acre in size. One of them might be about an acre and a half. Our fencing is 8 to 10 feet high. Some have lean-ins, some have hot wire to discourage climbing. We have double gated entry, a 3-foot horizontal dig guard, and we currently have 29 animals at our sanctuary.
And the animals that you have, they're not just wolves like the name would imply, right? It's wolves and then wolf dogs. Can you expand and educate viewers on what wolf dogs are and what that difference is?
A wolf dog is what it sounds like. It's a cross between a wild wolf and a domestic dog. Wolves and dogs don't look at each other as companions. They see each other as intruders. However, if you force them to live in confinement together, when the female goes into heat, they will breed and they will have a litter of puppies. When those puppies are born, every individual in that litter is going to be a mid-content wolf dog, 50-50, right down the middle, half wolf, half dog. Now, if you breed two of those wolf dogs together, it is theoretically possible to have a pure wolf and a pure dog be litter mates or any mix in between. So there are varying contents of wolf dogs. There's low content, which means it's more dog than wolf. There's mid content, which means half wolf, half dog. And then high content, which means more wolf than dog. Wolf dogs are extremely popular in the United States. It's estimated that as many as 150,000 wolf and wolf dog puppies are sold to be pets in the United States every year, and 90% of those animals are dead by the age of two due to neglect, abuse, abandonment, or euthanasia. A lot of people think it would be really cool to have a wolf dog as a pet, but they don't educate themselves. They don't realize that these animals don't act like regular domestic dogs. They're actually more cat-like. Everything's on their term. They can, if socialized at a young age, be very good companions. However, when they mature, they tend to do wild things. And by wild things, I mean urinate on everything, tear up the furniture, scratch up the carpeting, dig giant holes in the yard, kill smaller pets, run away constantly. All those things you don't want your dog to do, these guys have a tendency to do once they mature. For that reason, people dump them. Now, the sad part is when they dump them at a shelter or a rescue, if they mention anything about the animal being part wolf, for liability reasons, the shelter normally won't adopt them out and they will euthanize. And it has nothing to do with the animal's behavior or being vicious or anything like that. What it is the rabies vaccine is considered off-label. When a veterinarian gets a rabies vaccine, it lists on there what animals it's approved for. Wolf dogs are not one of those animals because the trials have never been done. They've never gone through the approval process. So for that reason, most shelters will not adopt out. They'll only release them to a sanctuary or euthanize them, unfortunately.
So within the U.S., that appeal of wolf dog hybrids is pretty high. Where do the rescues come from? Is there a big market within Colorado, or are you looking all across the U.S.?
We rescue animals from all over the country. First off, they're all captive born. Okay, none of our animals come from the wild. We rescue them from roadside attractions, illegal breeding operations, shelters, fur farms. And more often than not, we get them from people who change their mind. They get a puppy thinking this is going to be awesome, and then they don't want the puppy anymore. Unfortunately, there are way more wolf dogs out there that need to be rescued than there are places for them to go. The reality of it is you can't really save a lot of them, and the timing is everything. It's really very sad when I see the amount of animals out there that need to be helped. At our sanctuary alone, we get about 400 calls a year for animals that need to be rescued. And that's just us. That's not all of the other sanctuaries in the country. So because of that, I also administer a national electronic listserv of other sanctuaries and rescues and experienced owners of wolf dogs. So if we don't have room at our sanctuary, I can still post the animal that needs help to the listserv group in hopes that one of our members can help it.
Well, that's awesome. That's good that you're not only a place that can take, but you're also part of a community that can hopefully get the right care for these animals. One thing that I didn't know when you were first explaining Wolf Sanctuary is that that first generation between the wolf and the dog is what you called it was mid-content. Mid-content. So is that first generation always 50-50%?
If it's a pure wolf and a pure dog, yes.
Okay. And I know part of the work that you do is with phenotyping. Can you explain what that is and then how that works for you?
Okay. If I'm called to a shelter or by law enforcement because they think an animal has wolf content, I will go there, hopefully in person. I can do it by photos also, but I prefer to be there in person. And I will look at 20 different physical and behavioral characteristics of the animal. I break it down part by part: the nose, the muzzle, the teeth, the ears, the head, the chest, the forelegs, the back, the tail. And I just work my way down the entire animal. And what I do is I keep score, just tally marks. So I'll look at the nose. Is the nose black and textured? Yes, gets a point there. Okay, I look at the eyes. Are the eyes almond-shaped and oblique, meaning slanting inward toward the muzzle? And are they yellow in color? Well, they're kind of almond-shaped, but they're not really slanted and they're blue, so they don't get a point for that. Okay, and I just work my way down the whole animal. The more tally marks that animal gets, the more likely there's content and the higher that content is. The less there are could mean that it's just a domestic dog. Because, for instance, back to the nose, a black textured nose. That's not uniquely a wolf trait. Labrador retrievers also have black textured noses. So none of these traits in themselves would indicate that an animal has wolf content. But once you start accumulating points and keeping those tally marks, once I'm up around 7 or 8 or 9 tally marks, there's a good chance this animal is going to have some content. Once I'm up in the 12 and 13 and 14 range, definitely content, probably mid content. If I'm up around 18 or 19, this is very high content, possibly even a pure wolf. And then the behavioral part I look at is movement. Wolves have a very unique way of moving called single tracking. So when they walk or they trot, the rear legs swing in line with the front legs. And when they pick that front paw up, the back paw goes down in or very close to the same spot that front paw was standing. And so it gives the appearance in mud or snow that the animal's walking on 2 legs instead of 4. Another difference is when wolves run, their backs stay flat. When dogs run, they kind of bob back and forth. So those are the things that I look at when I phenotype. Now, it's a very subjective process. If you and I were to look at the same animal, you might think, no, I don't think that looks like a wolf's tail. And I might say, well, I think it looks like a wolf's tail. And so we'll have some disagreement the lower the content is. But the higher the content is, the more likely it is you and I are both going to look at it and agree and say, oh yeah, this is a wolf. When I do this, especially with law enforcement and shelter directors, I like to have them phenotype with me. So I will give them a score sheet too. And then I'll say, okay, this is what a muzzle's supposed to look like. And I'll say, what do you think? You think that matches that description? And I always have a little pamphlet with me to show examples of this is a husky's muzzle. This is a wolf's muzzle. Do you think it looks more like a husky or a wolf? So I get their buy-in that way. That way, when we come to a conclusion at the end, they're not going to fight me on it. They're going to say, well, I was part of this process and I agree with the outcome.
Yeah, that sounds like a great way to do it, where you're involving them and you're probably along the way also educating them so that the next time they see that, they might be more clued in to some of those differences. So that's phenotyping. Do you ever do genotyping, which looks at the genetics side of things?
Yes, we do both actually at the sanctuary. And a lot of times they match up pretty closely. Where I kind of struggle with the genotyping end is the low content animals, like the animals that will come back 8%. It's like those animals don't need to be at a sanctuary. They could just have that label removed. They could be curled up next to a fireplace in somebody's house somewhere instead of living outside in the elements 24/7 with no indoor access and with limited human interaction. An animal that's used to being around people and in a house, I think it's unjust to take that away from them. So when some of the shelters that call me say they insist on a DNA test, I cringe because I kind of know sometimes like, oh gosh, this is a dog for all intents and purposes. But if they do a DNA test, it's going to come back with 6 or 7% in it. And that's going to make it unadoptable. That part of the genotyping actually frustrates me. And it actually is still a fairly new science. It's not absolute. It's not 100% correct. Neither is phenotyping. So that's why doing both is probably the best way to get an accurate assessment of the animal.
On the website, it says that your work is with phenotyping and behavior. And so I was just curious. And I know recently with dogs in general, is people always want to know, oh, this different subbreeds of what type your dog is. And so I was curious if that existed for the wolf dog. I know the behavior is a lot of times why these wolf dog hybrids get either released or abandoned or brought to sanctuaries. And when I first came out to the Wolf Sanctuary, I talked with Michelle, and she said something that stuck with me about the difference between the two, that your normal dog will sort of sniff, sniff, lick, and wolf-dog hybrids will sort of lick, lick, bite. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that from Michelle? Can you expand on some of the differences between just a regular dog and then the wolf dogs?
It's a very typical wolf or wolf dog greeting. It's lick, lick, bite. It's like a toothy kiss. So they'll jump and they'll kind of nibble at you as they're licking you. Actually, it frightens some people, but once you get used to it, it's actually pretty endearing. It's pretty special. There are a lot of differences between wolf behavior and dog behavior, and wolf dog and dog behavior. Dogs are puppies through their entire life. They're pedomorphic. They never really mature mentally. So they go through their entire life being curious and being running around and checking things out. Whereas when wolves mature, they tend to become more timid and more cautious. They're neophobes. They're less likely to explore new things. It takes them a while to go over and check something out. And that's because they're hardwired to avoid conflict, because in the wild, if they get injured, it's a death sentence. So you got to remember, their prey is 10 times their size. If they get kicked and they get injured, they can no longer move with the pack. They can't hunt anymore. And it's the same with a strange object or a strange creature like a human. Wolves are a lot more timid than dogs are. Another thing that's different with wolves is wolves mate for life. They find a mate, and that is their mate for their entire life. Dogs are very promiscuous. If you had a pack of wild dogs, there would be numerous breeding pairs of dogs, and they wouldn't just be with each other. They would be all over the place. Whereas a pack of wolves is actually a family unit. Only the two breeders breed. Mom and dad at the top breed. And then below them is the three-year-olds. Below them is the 1 and 2-year-olds. And then the puppies at the bottom. And then when they reach maturity, they don't challenge mom or dad for breeding rights. They simply leave. They find a mate, and they form their own pack, like humans. Other things in behavior that I teach about is actually their communication. It's impossible for wolves to hide their intentions. They are constantly communicating with us. And so when you look at them, their main way of communicating is through body language, posture. And that's everything from the tip of the nose to how they're holding their tail, the positions of their ears to what their paws are doing. So you take those cues and you start looking at them, and you can kind of put them in order. And then you take into account on top of that their vocalization. Are they growling? Are they whimpering? Are they howling? You can put each of those pieces together and like a word. And then once you have them all arranged, it's a sentence. So you understand what the animal is saying to you. Perfect example is a wagging tail. A lot of people just jump to the conclusion he's wagging his tail. He's happy. That's not true. What it is the wagging of the tail only, it merely indicates how stimulated the animal is. But now if you take that wagging tail and you add to it mouth open a little bit, lips pulled back, maybe tongue sticking out a little bit, its eyes kind of squinty, you list those things and say, okay, this is probably a happy dog right here. So that's just an example of some of the more behavior stuff that I teach. Another thing that I help with is wolf dog owners that are struggling, and they call the sanctuary and say, I don't know what to do. He's acting up. He's escaping. He killed a goat. I help them to understand what's going through the animal's mind and what they can do to contain the animal or to calm the animal. And sometimes it's as simple as raising the fence 2 more feet. Sometimes it's filling in under the fence. Sometimes it's putting the animal on some medication. Some animals are damaged goods. They rescue them. The animal has been on its own and abused, and they're just crazy. And we don't want to see that animal get put down. So if we can maybe medicate the animal a little bit with some anti-anxiety drugs or something, that can often help the animal to make the transition into being a more secure member of that family.
I really like that at the heart of the Wolf Sanctuary, it's a no-kill shelter. So the animals that come there, you're going to give them the best life possible for their entire life. I'm curious if you see any similarities between like the TV documentary Tiger King, people wanting to play with exotic young tiger cubs, and the appeal to own wolf dogs.
Well, I can honestly say I've never seen an episode of Tiger King. but I know about Joe Exotic. I know what he's all about. And those kind of roadside attractions, yes, they cause people to want to interact with exotics. They cause people to want to own exotics and keep them as captive wildlife. I would say pets, but they're not really pets. They're more like prisoners, because you can't really have a tiger or a bear hanging around your house and sleeping in your bed. So they don't want to be there. Wolf dogs are kind of a different thing, because they're not a wolf and they're not a dog. They're kind of in between. So like I said, if they're socialized at a young age, they can make good companions. But still, wolves don't want to be contained. They don't want to be in cages. They want to be free. Unfortunately, though, people do keep them as pets. And it's just a reality with the captive wildlife crisis. And making it illegal wouldn't change anything. All that would do is force the industry underground and there'd be less oversight. So we're better off having it out in the open so that we can keep an eye on what is going on out there.
That's fine that you haven't seen any episodes of Tiger King. Kind of going off of that, in media, movies, and TV, wolves often get portrayed as the big bad wolf. They have a reputation. I'm curious if you know of any movies that do a good job of portraying the animals in an accurate light.
There was an animated one I saw, Princess Anunoka or something like that.
Oh, Princess Mononoke.
Yeah, that's the one. So that one was kind of more pro-wolf than a lot of the movies out there. We've had this ingrained in us since we were knee-high that the big bad wolf is going to eat our grandma, or it's going to blow our house down, you know, not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. And that's all from European folklore. And where that came from, to my knowledge, is in the 1600s or 1500s, people didn't want their kids wandering out in the woods and getting lost, scared, hurt, or killed. So they would tell them these stories about how the big bad wolf was waiting for them in the woods. After hundreds of years of hearing that story, you say it enough times and it becomes truth, but it's really not true. Like I mentioned earlier, wolves are hardwired to avoid us. They see us as a serious threat to their safety. And the thing I bring up to people when they ask me how I can think that way is that in 1995 and 1996, wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone National Park, wild wolves, okay? And there's a healthy population of wolves in Yellowstone National Park. Since they were reintroduced, millions of people have camped and hiked in that backcountry. And we don't hear about wolves attacking people. They stay away from us. So if you look at the difference between the way Europeans' folklore portrays wolves compared to how Native Americans' folklore portrays wolves, they're entirely different. Native American folklore sees the wolf as a teacher. The wolf taught us how to live in communities. The wolf taught us how to hunt successfully. So I think it all depends on your culture. But I do know that they are villainized regularly, movie after movie after movie, and book after book after book.
And you touched on something interesting with the reintroduction into Yellowstone, which is that in Colorado, there was an initiative put on the ballot to reintroduce wolves, which passed. And then shortly thereafter, wolves actually ended up migrating from Wyoming down into Colorado. I'm hoping you can provide a little bit of insight into what a Colorado with wolves might look like. And you painted a picture of wolves don't really attack people. They're not going to go out of their way to hunt people. They're timid, like you're saying. So what does a Colorado with wolves look like in your opinion?
Well, I'm not part of the reintroduction program, but from what I've heard and read, they're not going to be releasing wolves into populated areas. It's going to be out in open space, way on the western slope, where there's not a heavy population of people. There may be some wolf rancher conflict because, let's face it, cows are pretty easy to bring down compared to a bison or a moose. But there are ways to keep that from happening. There are non-lethal ways to deter wolves. So I think a Colorado with wolves, we're not going to see them. They're going to see us before we're going to see them. You have to be a backwoodsman or something like that, or possibly a ranch hand to maybe see a wolf in Colorado once they're reintroduced. For the most part, I think wolves are going to keep to themselves. I think there will be occasional conflict with the ranchers, but with hazing and being proactive about protecting their cattle, I don't see it becoming a big problem.
Bringing things back to the wolf sanctuary, what are some of the best successes that the Wolf Sanctuary's seen while it's been operating, or at least in your time there?
As far as rescues go?
Yeah, just in general, if there's any stories that pop out about successful things that the Wolf Sanctuary's done.
I mean, just the fact that we keep 29 or 30 animals at a time alive and well cared for, animals that would otherwise have been dead, that's a success story in itself. I mean, that's our whole mission, is to provide them with a good life. We have one wolf named Ember who was part of a place in Minnesota called Fur Ever Wild, F-U-R Ever Wild. And what they did at that facility was absolutely nightmarish. They would have people pay a fee to be able to interact with the puppies and get their pictures taken and everything. Then when the animals would turn 2 years old, they would kill them, skin them, and sell the pelts in the gift shop. Ember was one of those animals at that place. It got shut down after a very long legal battle. And then when the people who went in to get the animals got there, the animals had already been all snuck out. So they weren't there anymore. Enter Joe Exotic. Hey, guess what? It turns out that he had some of those animals. And so the people that went to shut down the facility actually went to Joe Exotics, got the animals from them, took them to their facility in California. And at that time, we were looking for a companion for one of ours whose companion had just passed away. And they said, hey, we have one from that Forever Wild place that doesn't get along with anybody if you want to come get her. So we went and got her, brought her back, and she is now with Jacob, who's a big, beautiful boy, and they're a couple. They get along great. Jacob's another good story. Jacob, he's not certified a pure wolf, but if you looked at him, you would say he's as pure as anything that's in the wild. Jacob was raised by a family in New Jersey from a very young puppy and kept enclosed in between two homes in an alleyway, and he escaped. And we're talking Rahway, New Jersey, which is basically a suburb of New York. He actually made the evening news back there because he was running down the street and people were filming him. He ended up being safely captured and they brought him out to us, and he's been with us since. So those are two stories off the top of my head of success stories with animals. Every animal has their own story. I mean, not one is more sensational or more important than another. It's just, they're all different. Just like all the personalities of the animals are different. Another success with Wolf is our educational end of things. We not only educate people on why wolves and wolf dogs don't make good pets, we also help people that have already taken that step and have one in their possession as a pet and are having trouble with it, as I mentioned earlier. So it's kind of a two-pronged approach with education. Another thing I've noticed, there aren't a lot of people sitting on the fence when it comes to their opinion about wolves.
No, yeah, totally.
Yeah, pretty much they hate them or they love them. Very few people are indifferent. And so I think it's really important in our public outreach to first try not to anger anybody who has a differing opinion. And then also try to get to the kids, get the kids to understand that wolves aren't these big, bloodthirsty, horrible creatures, that they have every right to live and raise their family as we do. We can easily avoid conflict with wolves in the wild. It's not that hard to do. I think that a wolf would have to be either rabid or absolutely starving to death to attack a grown human. I don't know about, you know, children, but children shouldn't be out in the wilderness by themselves anyway, and chances are they won't be. As far as I know, in the past 100 years, there have been 2 wolf attacks in the United States or North America. One was a woman, a teacher, that went jogging. She was in Alaska. She went jogging in well-established wolf territory in a blizzard. They mistook her for prey, and so they killed her. The second was they found a man who was partially eaten. It was determined that it was wolves that ate him. They were not able to determine whether the wolves killed the man or if he died from another cause, and then they fed on him. Those are the only two that I'm aware of in the past 100 years.
Interesting. I think it goes back to the good work that the Wolf Sanctuary does with your success stories about those two wolves, and that every dog has its own history and you're providing a space where they get to live that out. So if viewers want to support you or the Wolf Sanctuary, what's the best way for them to do that?
We're a nonprofit, so we're always in need of donations, whether it's our Amazon wish list, meat donations, or cash donations, because quite frankly, we wouldn't be able to survive without donors. The best way would be to go to www.wolfsanctuary.co. You could also get there by going to www.wolfsanctuary.net. They'll take you to the same website, and there's a donation button on there. Or you can just scroll through and see what our Amazon wish list is about. Another thing is teach people what you learn. Teach people that wolves and wolf dogs don't make good pets and tell them why. Share the information that we share with you. And then lastly, you can always volunteer. We're always in need of volunteers. A lot of our volunteers are college students. We have an internship program. And if somebody is interested in wanting a wolf dog for some reason, the best thing for them to do would be to volunteer and see what these animals are about and see if you really want one in your house. Because, <Yeah. laughs> because I'll tell you, you wouldn't want some of these guys in your house. I can promise you that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Keith, thanks so much for having this conversation today, for being a part of it. I certainly learned a lot. I know that the viewers are going to really appreciate everything that you brought to the podcast today. So thank you so much for being part of this.
And thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
I really enjoyed having this conversation with Keith. You can sense his compassion for these wolf dogs, as well as his knowledge about these beautiful and often misunderstood animals. Also, it was fun to revisit an organization that was the focus of our first piece of content ever. It has been such a fulfilling journey to be able to build and maintain these partnerships over time and to help these animal organizations grow. Now, to answer our question from this episode's round of What's That Animal? Remember that today we're not only trying to figure out the animal, but to ask ourselves why that animal might be making the noise. One last time, here's the sound. These are the sounds of wolves and wolf dog hybrids howling. I couldn't resist myself using this soundbite, especially since this is audio from that very first video we produced. But to answer the question of why wolves howl, if you think they're just howling at the moon like those wolf t-shirts depict, that isn't quite right. There are a few reasons why they howl. One of them is to communicate the location of pack members. In the open tundra, a wolf's howl can carry up to 10 miles, so it can act as a sort of roll call. Wolves are also territorial animals, so it can be a warning sign to other wolf packs in the area to establish boundaries. And lastly, it can act as a rallying cry during a hunt. A wolf's howl is just so iconic, and I love that we were able to witness something like that and share it with you. Tune in next episode for another chance to play
What's That Animal?
If you enjoyed this conversation, subscribe and consider supporting us directly at patreon.com/onewildpodcast. Here, you'll find exclusive content, like the full video versions of our conversations. To find out more about the other work we do, visit our website at onewildpodcast.com. Follow us on Instagram at @theechoanimals and follow our TikTok at creature.feature. On behalf of all animals, thank you for listening.